We have now four presentations for the afternoon, so we're going to try to stay on track time-wise. The first presentation is by Professor Elster, who is going to talk about the optimal design of a constituent assembly. And the discussant will be Arnaud Le Pilouer, who is an assistant professor in law at the University of Cergy-Pontoise. Thank you.
Thanks for that. I've been working on the constitution-making process for close to 20 years, mainly from a positive or explanatory perspective, just trying to see how the organization of constituent assemblies can explain the document that was finally adopted. So I have not taken a normative stand on constitutions. That is, I've not written about the optimal constitution, although I have some thoughts about certain things that should not be in a constitution, and perhaps also about some things that should be in constitutions. That has never been my main topic. But as a side product of my interest in the effect of various designs of the constituent assembly on the document that is adopted, I started to think some years ago about another normative issue, namely the optimal design of the constitution-making process itself. And just as a good constitution, a constitution that works, is a complex piece of machinery, of interlocking parts, it turned out that a good constituent assembly also probably should be a pretty complex set of interlocking parts. That's at least what I'm going to argue. Let me just indicate briefly the main empirical reference I'm going to draw on in this presentation. I've mainly been working since, I guess, the summer of 1990 on comparing the French Assemblée Constituante and the Federal Convention. But over the years, I've also studied a number of other constitutions, probably twice as many as listed here, but these are the ones that I discuss often quite briefly in the paper. So, So first let me ask the question, the expert versus the assembly, Solon or the Federal Convention? Would it be better to entrust the task of writing a constitution to a single individual? Now, that has not very often happened, but arguably, although no one really knows, that is what Solon did, and arguably with remarkable success. Now, here's one simple argument why one might think that preferable. If you entrust the task of writing a constitution to a group, a committee, an assembly, it would be surprising if unanimity was achieved and if not some compromises were required. But since, as I just said, a constitution is a complex piece of interlocking parts, compromises over each of these parts might be detrimental to the viability of the whole. So here's just a simple stylistic representation. Both the combinations AB and A prime B prime might be perfectly viable, but a compromise is briefly indicated as A plus A prime half and B plus B prime half might not be viable. Nevertheless, I'm not going to address that issue, whether Solon or the Federal Convention is preferable, but assume that there's going to be an assembly. So here's a basic structure of the paper. First, I'm going to state very briefly a framework I've been working with or within for some years now as of motivations as parsed into interest, reason, and passion. Then I'm going to address the tasks of the Constituent Assembly, in particular whether a Constituent Assembly should or should not at the same time be serve as an ordinary legislator. Then I'm going to discuss two quantitative aspects, the size and the duration of the assembly. I'm not going to say much about the duration. And I'm going to briefly refer to a surprising aspect, perhaps the geographical location of the assembly. Then I'm going to say a bit more about the election of delegates to the assembly and of secrecy versus publicity, or the proceedings of the assembly, that is, of the debates. And in the following section, I'm going to discuss the internal organization of the assembly, including the issue of secret versus public voting. I think it's useful when discussing secrecy versus publicity to also make the distinction between debates and the votes. And I think I'll probably skip section 9 and go straight to the summary. So for our purposes today, or when we started to think about this colloquium, Helene and I had to make up my mind on what I meant by wisdom. And it turned out to go beyond what I thought of as reason, which, you know, what Madison called the mild voice of reason, which I had understood as impartiality, impartial motivations. Because obviously, even the best of motivations might not take us very far if the framers have, you know, poor beliefs. Not necessarily biased beliefs, but simply insufficiently informed beliefs. So I think my approach to wisdom, whether individual or collective, is impartial motivation and rational beliefs, where impartiality, crucially, extends not just across individuals, but across time, because in the Constitution is written, George Mason wrote to his son at the eve of the convention, for millions yet unborn. Some kind of temporal impartiality would seem crucial. And at the convention, the framers, in fact, demonstrated such temporal impartiality when they refused to privilege the original 13 states over future Western states that might accede to the Union later on. So impartial motivations can also be stated negatively, minimize the role of personal or group interest or passion. And rational beliefs have two main components, optimal information gathering and optimal information processing. I'm not sure I'll be able to spell out those as well as I would have liked to, but I'm also hoping that the conference as a whole will enable me to do that later. So let me first mention some types of constituent assemblies, depending on whether and how they are at the same time serving as ordinary legislators. And I rank them from most to least desirable. They are constitutional conventions, US 1787, Bonn 1949, Norway 1814, a few others. These are few and far between. Mixed assemblies that have both functions are much more frequent. Some of them have an explicit mandate from the voters to serve both functions, as in France in 1789 or in France in 1946. Some are elected as constituent assemblies and then arrogate to themselves the role of legislators. Some are elected as legislators and then arrogate to themselves the right to modify the constitution. And here are some arguments for and mainly against mixed assemblies. Well, the paradox sort of is the following. Assuming, as I'm going to argue, that pure conventions are normatively better than mixed assemblies of any of the three kinds, why are there so few of them? And I think it's maybe often been seen as awkward or weird to have two assemblies working in parallel, as was the case in the US in 1787, where the Continental Congress and the Federal Convention operated in parallel without any friction or any problems. But in the two other cases I mentioned here, in Colombia 1991 and Venezuela 1999, there was, in fact, a kind of war between the assemblies with clearly undesirable outcomes. And in a speech from 1793 that Arnaud Le Pillouet pointed me to, Robespierre warned strongly against a system of dual assemblies, which he thought would lead to civil war. I can't quite understand it, but it is a fact that they are much less frequent than the mixed assemblies, against which there are at least the following arguments. First, a constituent legislator might write a legislature-centered constitution, that is, at the expense of the executive and the judiciary. There are many examples. And there could be path dependence in the sense that what the assembly decides wearing its legislative hat might create a precedent somehow for the decisions it makes wearing its constitutional hat. There could be a risk of logrolling of legislative and constituent decisions. And finally, in a mixed assembly, either governability, which, as I'll argue, is needed for choosing a government, or representativeness, which is desirable for an assembly that is to write a constitution, will suffer. So, all in all, I think there are pretty strong arguments for having pure conventions, but it is a puzzle that they are so rare. Now, next section is about size. And here I make arguments both for a large assembly and for a small assembly, and assume that the optimal size is, I don't know, maybe in the low 100s or something. Madison's argument that I cited early this morning was that the assembly should be large enough to prevent bargaining or coalitions or fractions forming, which was fine, of course, in his time before the rise of political parties. Today, bargaining and logrolling will inevitably happen whatever the size of the assembly, because there will be logrolling among the parties, not among individuals. If we think, and still assuming no political parties, that strategic voting and logrolling are bad things, and I think the jury is out on those issues, but if we think that, then once again a small assembly is to be avoided. And finally, a positive argument for large assemblies might seem to be derived from Condorcet's jury theorem, about which I'm sure we'll hear more during these days. Now, arguments for small assembly. First, if you want secrecy, sorry for the typo there, if you want secrecy, and more about that later, then that's obviously easier to achieve in a small assembly than in a large one. What Madison said essentially was a large assembly would create chaos. And another argument that I think was invented by Bentham in 1789 and rediscovered, unless I'm mistaken, in 2003 by two political scientists, is that in a large assembly, there's a tendency for the delegates to free ride on information gathering or others. So there will be suboptimal information in investment in the acquisition of information. And Bentham, in fact, wrote this directly as advice to the French framers when they were sort of putting together the format and protocol for the Constituent Assembly. He wrote this in French. I'll not say much about the duration of the assembly. I think a time limit is probably desirable because there have been instances where an open-ended constituent process has enabled the more patient sides to the process to extract concessions, substantive concessions from others. That is, they got a more favorable document in exchange for an earlier adoption of the document. So if that is seen as normatively undesirable, which I think it is, there should probably be a time limit. And today, this doesn't seem as the second issue doesn't seem like a major one, but as late as in 1919, the choice of Weimar for the Constituent Assembly of Germany after the First World War was very deliberate because at the time there was essentially a civil war raging in Berlin. So to have had the Constituent Assembly in Berlin would have been to invite what happened in Frankfurt in 1848 or in Paris in 1789. And thus, not simply far from major urban agglomerations, but also far from troop concentrations, a clause that was actually inscribed into the first French constitution with respect not to the Constituent Assembly, but with respect to the legislature. So, elections to the Constituent Assembly. I take it for granted, and I think it is reflected in historical experience of conveners of Constituent Assemblies, that it is desirable to have elections with proportional representation, with no threshold or a low threshold to ensure diversity. And I cite a couple of passages in the paper, one from, not from Louis XVI, although he signed the document, but probably from his minister, Necker, and one from a historian of the American Constitution, to the effect that we want diversity not to represent the interests of minorities, but to represent their knowledge, the kind of things they're familiar with from their personal experience, which is, in fact, quite close to the 18th century Burkean idea of virtual representation that I think has been largely discarded today in democratic theory, but which might perhaps have a place in the normative theory of the Constituent Assembly. Now, what I don't quite know is the answer to the question, knowledge of what? So in the paper I say, well, are two things, knowledge of where the shoe pinches and knowledge of how to mend the shoe. Mm-hmm. And I have, I think Scott would probably emphasize the second. I couldn't really see how I could fit that into the proceedings of the constituent assemblies I know of. I think the representation of knowledge of shoe pinching was more important than representation of knowledge about cobbling. But maybe we could discuss that. Now, I also mentioned, as a completely irrelevant but sort of tragic aside, that in three of the cases where diversity was chosen and representativeness was chosen, the outcome was disastrous in a sense that the French Revolution might not have taken the violent course it did, Hitler might not have taken power, and the Czechoslovak Federation might not have broken up. Because all of these things arguably happened because of representativeness. I don't think there's a deeper lesson in those disturbing facts, but if there is one, one would obviously have to rethink some of the questions. So then this question of secrecy versus publicity. And in favor of publicity, it has been argued for a long time, Bentham is very eloquent on the topic, that publicity reduces the scope for private interest bargaining, or as Judge Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. So that's one argument. Also, publicity may be required if the assembly is large, simply on the negative grounds that secrecy will be feasible. Somebody will always leak. So in favor of secrecy, I make a couple of arguments. Here I'm talking about secret debates. I'm going to talk about secret voting in a second. So first, secrecy reduces the role of passions, vanity, playing to the audience, and fear, being threatened by members of the audience if they can observe you. And this was not a vain fear in 1789 in Paris or 1848 in Frankfurt. And I should also mention, although it's somewhat irrelevant, a hallucinatory phrase by de Gaulle, who explained in conversations with Alain Perefit how his reasoning for coming back in 1958. He said, talking about himself in the third person, as he usually did, if de Gaulle had not come back, there would have been the para on Paris, the parliamentarians in the Seine, the general strike, and a government by the Americans. So that's what he wanted to avoid. And so clearly, in May 1958, a lot of French parliamentarians were physically afraid. Don't think there's any question of that. That may have played into their essentially abdicating their role and handing their constituent power over to de Gaulle. Now, secrecy, by virtue of eliminating vanity and by making it easier for delegates to change their mind as a result of argument, improves the quality of argument if argument is what is going on. So there are sort of two parallel effects of secrecy. One is to move the tenor of proceedings from arguing to bargaining, and the other is to improve the quality of whatever arguing is left. Now, here is a twist that I hadn't thought of until recently. In a constituent assembly, most of the issues at stake are issues at which private interest has little purchase. For instance, for an individual delegate, whether the majority required in Congress to overturn a presidential veto should be 2/3 or 3/4 cannot possibly, I would think, make any difference to the private interest of any framer, and many similar issues. So if the assembly wisely chooses to limit itself to broad issues of constitutional design, then the risk that interest might predominate in secret proceedings would be much reduced, because interest wouldn't have a purchase. The interest of the delegates wouldn't tell them how to vote. And since secrecy also, as I argued, reduces the role of passions, only reason would be left. Well, it would never be the case, but that's what I'm driving at. I have a brief discussion of the internal organization of the assembly. I argue, without really taking a firm position, that a bicameral assembly may be needed, essentially to make the assembly able to keep its promises to itself. And we saw from the days of August 9, 1789, that the French framers, who had imposed on themselves a rule of voting on 3 successive dates, that had just decided to violate that rule, and nobody could hold them to account, because he that can bind can also unbind. Whereas the virtue of bicameralism is that somebody else, an upper chamber, can hold a lower chamber to account. That's what argued both by Delorme and by Etienne Dumont, more or less around the same time. Well, no bound mandates, I think, is clearly desirable if you want reason, argument, to have a role at the assembly. And finally, there's the issue of public or secret voting. So I'm suggesting that if debates are public, either to ensure diversity, if debates are public because the assembly has to be large to ensure diversity, then the voting should be secret to insulate the framers against passion. And then an additional benefit of secret voting would be to make log rolling impossible, because when you can't know how anyone votes, you might vote sincerely. I was discussing briefly with Pasquale before the session, and he said that in some ways this is sort of irrelevant, because in modern times, political parties tell delegates how to vote. But I said, well, maybe even if in Italy in 1946, if they had imposed secret voting, even the communists might have voted their conscience, because nobody would have been able to hold them to account afterwards. So in ordinary assemblies, you want to be able to hold representatives to account. But in a constituent assembly, I don't see the need for holding framers to account. If you want a downstream control on the assembly, you just use ratification of the document rather than holding the framers individually to account. So let me just summarize in 3 points, going back to where I started from. First, how to minimize the role of interest, which can be achieved through a number of ways. To exclude log rolling, bargaining, and strategic voting, assuming these to be undesirable, the size of the assembly should not be too small. And to exclude log rolling, one might also impose secret voting. And to exclude log rolling between legislative and constituent issue, the assembly should only have the task of writing the constitution, not also that of adopting legislation. Bound mandates should be excluded. The assembly should focus on issues of broad constitutional design, with regard to which individual or group interests are neutral. And to prevent the more patient parties from gaining an unfair bargaining advantage, the assembly should work under a time limit. And finally, to exclude a self-enhancing legislator-centric bias, the assembly should not at the same time serve as an ordinary legislator. So, to minimize the role of passion, to exclude audience pressure that might bring delegates under the sway of emotion, vanity, or fear, the assembly should debate in secret or, alternatively, vote in secret. an isolated location of the assembly may serve the same end. And to prevent the assembly from giving in to sudden impulses, a bicameral organization might or might not be needed. And finally, maximizing epistemic quality. First, optimal information gathering. Elections to the assembly should be organized to ensure diversity and representativeness. The idea of virtual representation is to have many epistemic perspectives and a variety of experience represented, not to have each of them represented in proportion to its numerical importance in the electorate. And second, optimal information processing. To prevent free riding on the information of others, the assembly should not be too large. And a couple of things I didn't mention earlier, but which are in the paper. The rules of debating should favor exchanges rather than prepared speeches. Many of the French observers of the Assemblée Constituante cited the English practice of forbidding speaking from manuscripts in Parliament, which probably would have been good in France too. And finally, speaking should be viewed as a function serving the needs of the assembly, not as an individual right. I think I'll stop there.
I would have, of course, many questions or observations to make about this lecture, but I'm just going to expose just a few of them. They actually are of two kinds. The first one question the purpose itself and can be called general. The second ones are more specific and focus on particular ideas or phases developed in the paper. Let me start with the general observations. The ambition of your paper in framing the optimal design of a constituent assembly is to take a purely procedural approach, as you said in the introduction, in the sense, I quote your paper here, that you shall remain agnostic as to the nature of the optimal constitution. Obviously, the first important question is whether this is a reasonable ambition. Are the choices made about the procedure of constitution making really independent of those made about the content of the constitution? Moreover, are they purely technical choices or do they carry political values? You argue that there is no specific outcome that the process is supposed to be tracking, and that your sole ambition here is to eliminate or minimize the features that from the ex ante point of view are likely to lead to bias of one kind or another. But the question remains of which bias should be avoided when the drafting of a constitution is at stake. You claim that in this matter the influence of passion and interest are to be minimized and that the epistemic quality of decisions, on the contrary, has to be maximized. The arguments that justify those choices are quite convincing, no doubt about that, but in my point of view, that they remain choices. I mean choices that reveal values and therefore choices that firstly can be discussed on the ground of other values and secondly are connected somehow to choices that have to be made in a constitution. For instance, your point that the influence of passion has to be minimized may be related with a theory in which the constitutional bodies have to balance each other and this is an argument against monocameralism, for example. Here comes a second general question. If any choice of a procedure for constitution making is the expression of preferences, who is supposed to make this choice? An obvious answer would be the authority that convokes an assembly, because such an authority always exists, logically always exists. An assembly has to be called by someone. But precisely, we can observe that, in fact, this kind of authorities usually don't decide much. These authorities don't have or don't think to have the legitimacy to impose conditions on the Constituent Assembly. The few ones who did try to impose such conditions had to ground their prescriptions in the legitimacy of the people. That is, for example, what the gouvernement provisoire did in France in 1945. it prepared a kind of constitution, a pre-constitution for the Constituent Assembly, and this constitution had to be ratified by the people in order to be able to bind the future assembly. My question is then, is the design you have drawn for a Constituent Assembly legitimate enough because it is optimal, or do you think it would need the approbation of the people as well? My third general observation is the following. When a Constituent Assembly is called, writing a constitution is not the only problem that the state faces. Other problems do matter and have to be fixed in time. For instance, producing laws, which will be effectively applied by the administration, and that supposes a government. Negotiating international treaties, and even go to war. Yet, when a Constituent Assembly is called, there is a more general matter than the optimal design of constitution making, I mean, including that of the Constituent Assembly. What matters is the optimal design of the institutions in general so that all the tasks would be well fulfilled. And to that extent, obviously, the conditions that make for optimal constitution making may not be the same as the ones that make for optimal decision making in general, including constitution making. My point is not that the conditions for optimal constitution making would hardly be met. You answered the objection in the paper. My point is that those very conditions could contradict the conditions for optimal decision-making in general, and even more, that they could spoil the process of constitution-making itself. Besides, you give an example of this danger in your paper. When you claim that a Constituent Assembly should not at the same time serve as an ordinary legislature, the alternatives, like legislation by another assembly or by the government, are potentially conflictual, as you said, and this kind of conflict could be dangerous for the drafting of the constitution itself. Finally, I would like to call into question some of your specific assertions. The first one is the same I just mentioned. You set aside the constituent legislatures because, I quote again, they may be subject to a self-enhancing bias, in the sense of creating an excessively strong legislative branch with correspondingly weak executive and judicial branches. For you, this bias might stem from one of two sources, and I will question each of them. The first one is the hope of the members of a constituent legislature to be elected in the first post-constitutional assembly. On that one, I would just object that the situation of members of a convention wouldn't be so different. I don't see why they couldn't have very similar hopes. That is why the second source is the decisive one, if I understand well. The fact that the members naturally come to think that the institution to which they belong is a particularly important one. On that point, I think the same argument can be raised. One might fear that members of conventions would think that conventions are a very important institution and that they would express this belief in the constitution, for instance, by providing for a very regular call of conventions, solution which could alter the stability of the constitution. My second particular observation concerned the claim for a distant location of the assembly. A claim that appeared to me a little dated. But you have anticipated the objection in your speech. But I wonder if the same objection couldn't be raised about secrecy. At least as a mean of avoiding the effect of fear. Because I'm not sure it would be the secrecy of debates would be efficient. Actually, it wouldn't be a major inconvenience if it just wasn't efficient, but I'm afraid it would be just partly efficient, which would be much worse. because it could protect from the pressure of the street, but certainly not from the pressure of organized bodies. And maybe this kind of precautions could create inequity within the people. Only some powerful and organized bodies being able to put pressures on the deputies. Well, as I'm running out of time, I will let this question to be discussed among others, I hope, with the audience.
Excellent comments. I'm afraid I didn't understand the very first one about passion and need for bicameralism. I missed there. The second point about whether these conditions, assuming them to be optimal, wouldn't themselves wouldn't an approval of these conditions wouldn't have to be part of the upstream process of constitution making. I think that might be quite reasonably imposed. In the paper, I say that the optimal constitution-making process on a national scale should be hourglass-shaped, with broad national consultation preceding and succeeding the narrow debates in the assembly itself. And part of those narrow, broad upstream consultations can very well include a vote on these conditions that I have enumerated. But my task in this paper, as I say in the beginning, in the introduction, is a little bit artificial. I'm essentially asking the following question. Suppose there were an omniscient, omnipotent being who could impose these conditions, which would then be followed. Which conditions would we want that being to impose? Which is slightly artificial and maybe a somewhat more realistic idea would be to include approval of the conditions by the population prior to the actual meeting of the assembly. It's also artificial, as I say in the paper, in a sense that on the one hand I claim that the assembly should be organized so as to minimize the role of passion. On the other hand, all historical experience shows that the constituent assemblies tend to be called in times of passion and turbulence and often violence. So this is a somewhat, you know, self-contradictory proposition, which I'm once again simply solving by fiat in the way I just indicated. I think the arguments that are now made against a separation of the legislative and constituent powers could, in a given situation, be quite persuasive. One can imagine a case in which separation of these two powers could be destructive, suicidal. And that was, as I said, Robespierre's claim. And almost what happened in the two Latin American countries that I cited, where the president created by unconstitutional means a constituent assembly as a part of his ongoing warfare with the ordinary legislature. It's, in a way, I have to give the same weak, feeble answer to that objection as I gave to the other ones. That is, I'm trying to isolate the task of the assembly from anything else that might be going on. And I'm imagining, for instance, that you have a period of calm and quiet, as in Sweden in the 1970s, where it is decided that the existing constitution is too, ridden with ancient, pointless clauses, and that it's necessary to start from scratch. In such a situation, where there's no internal or external crisis or passion or turbulence or violence whatsoever, if the decision is made to create a new constitution from scratch, then I claim that the conditions that I enumerate would be the optimal ones. Under conditions where these features do not are not found, then you might want to deviate from that. I don't know. It should be easy to find out from American constitutional history whether pure conventions have a greater tendency to write periodic conventions into the constitutions than mixed assemblies. You know, the data are there, so that should be possible to find. I haven't come across the statement that they tend to do. It was a very common fear in the American states in a revolutionary period that constituent legislatures would be legislature-centric. I've never seen anyone voice the fear that pure conventions might be convention-centered, but it's certainly a possibility, which can be, you know, could be verified. Finally, about location. Well, we've got now secrecy. It's true that lobbying interests might always be able to use either to bribe or threaten the delegates to get their way. It is true. But what about using secret voting? If you use secret voting, you take that weapon away. You cannot control them.
So. Well, I'm not sure of that because, even with secret voting, especially when parties nowadays are organized, it's possible to count the voters and to know approximately who followed the rule and who didn't.
Well, I'm assuming that this could be done. And I'm assuming that secrecy could be achieved. I don't think it could ever be technically impossible to ensure secrecy of voting. I find that hard to imagine.
Thanks. You have a couple of observations and questions about this fascinating use by Bentham of this point about how the expected benefit of voting goes down with the size of the assembly. It's an absolutely familiar point, right, in political science with large numbers of regular voters, but it takes on a number of different aspects in an assembly that I hadn't thought about. But I wonder whether what we should think about whether he's really right this makes a difference. One consideration is that there's controversy about what the chance of being decisive is in a given size of assembly. Jerry tells me on the latest thinking that it's just roughly 1 over n. So now, if there's some significant cost to voting, which I'll come back to, the difference between 1 in 100 and 1 in 800 maybe isn't going to be a big factor in one's deliberations, as opposed to 1 in 100 versus 1 in 100 million, or 1 in 10 and 1 in 100 million. So the fact that the numbers are very small chances of being decisive in either case is interesting in the assembly, because you've got a very limited range of size of assemblies that you're considering.
Well, here's my thinking about this. I'm assuming that in any case, there will always be more investment in information-seeking than a rational person would do. In any case.
I was going to come to information-seeking. This was just about casting the vote, which he also mentioned.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's...
So information will be... Yeah, okay. So another point, though, about the assembly is if you're already in the assembly, voting is virtually costless. It's not like missing a TV show and going to the polls and all that, which comes in. You're sitting there, all you have to do is say aye or whatever. So that also changes the calculus. So there might be just no reason not to vote. That leaves this question about becoming informed, which is going to be costlier. But there are more ways of exercising your enlightenment in assembly than just voting. Another major way is speaking. Okay, so now, what does the size of the assembly have on the chance of making your enlightenment effective through speaking? One consideration is that I don't think the size of the audience in any way diminishes or dilutes the value of making a good point. It might even enhance it. So that's not bad. There's a possibility that if it's a big assembly, your chance to speak will be reduced, right? Either you won't get to speak as long or you may not get a chance to speak at all. But we should be careful with that too. I mean, I think especially in constitutional assemblies where they're not public, it's not like people are clamoring to talk all the time. It may be that everybody gets to say everything they want, in which case, just sort of going out on a limb here, there might be very strong incentives to be very well informed with an eye to the chance of making a very good point to a decent number of people. So I wonder what you think about those things.
Well, I think there are two quotes from Bentham. One of them mentions voting, but both of them mention, you know, bothering to get to inform oneself what is at stake, rather than simply, as I said, free riding on what the others are doing. And if everybody does that, of course, it will be an uninformed, low-quality decision. And I still think that argument is unaffected by what you said. And what I was trying to say earlier was that if people gathered information according to pure rational choice theory, they would gather so little, both in assembly of 100 and in assembly of 800, that the difference might not be that important. But since I tend to think that people would, just as they are more likely to vote when the expected outcome of elections is close than when it's expected to be a big difference, although it's equally rational in both cases, I think they would be more likely to gather information when the assembly is small than when it's large, although it's equally irrational in both cases. So that's...
Just as an empirical.
Yeah.
And what about the chance of having an effect through speaking, which changes the calculus a lot? It's not diluted.
No. I cited in the paper this article by Bertrand de Jouvenel, which I thought was quite good. The chairman's dilemma, whom to recognize, basically, in an assembly of 1,200 delegates. Whom do you recognize?
And I
suggested, and I think following him, that the chairman should view speaking as a function, not as a right. So certainly the chairman should try to select those whom he thinks could have something important to say. That's
which helps this point, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Thanks, Jan. Let me start with the distinction between maybe two types of costs that a badly designed constituent assembly could end up imposing. One is we might call error costs, so the final product, the final constitution that's produced is bad in some way. But another important one is some kind of opportunity cost. That is, we might have a breakdown in the constituent assembly. It might fail to produce a constitution at all. Or it might simply take too long to do so. So this point about opportunity costs is, I guess, a variant of Arnaud's point about the circumstances of constitution making. If we're making constitution in a situation where time is of the essence, or there's a high premium on producing something quickly, even if it might be less than ideal, then we'd want to design the constituent assembly to take account of opportunity cost as well. I thought most of your proposals were quite persuasive on the dimension of error cost, but maybe didn't take into account opportunity cost. So making the constituent assembly bicameral slows the proceedings. It might make the final product of higher quality, but that might not be worth it. So,
no, I think more or less also what Arnaud said, and I agree with both of you, except in my weak or feeble response that imagine Sweden in 1975. What should we tell the Swedes to do in 1975? The opportunity costs of writing a new constitution there will be close to zero, I believe. Set up a separate parallel constituent assembly of, you know, wise men and women, and let the ordinary parliament go about its work, and then follow my recipe. I think that's my feeble response. It's feeble because, as I've said many times, that's not how constitutions typically are written. I still think it has sort of some kind of abstract conceptual normative interest to, you know, to go through these hypothetical scenarios as sort of first best choices, and then, as usual, one could then take the next step and ask how would under circumstances where some of these conditions could not, as a matter of fact, be fulfilled, including zero opportunity cost, what would then the second best options or designs be?
Jerry Mackey? Jan, you raised an issue that I wouldn't have thought of except that you mentioned it. So of
of whether a constitution should be written by one person or by the assembly. And if you wouldn't have mentioned it, you wouldn't have this question from me. Among the ancient Greeks, there was much constructive constitution making, especially when they were founding new colonies. But there was a contrasting school of thought that the best constitution could only come from an extraordinary lawgiver. Particularly the role of Lycurgus in founding Sparta, which was supposedly admirable for its mixed constitution and allegedly for its 800 years of stability, although it was only 180 years. And Plato's Republic is, in one sense, is an idealized version of Lycurgus. And thereafter in the history of political thought, the theme of an extraordinary lawgiver was prominent, and it continued. You can find it in Machiavelli and Rousseau, in that you have to. The only alternative is to have a Moses, Lycurgus, or a Numa. And Rousseau said this, and we're on the eve of the French Revolution, where instead of relying on an extraordinary lawgiver, they went to an assembly. So. At one point in time, it was a live debate, and maybe Bernard and Pasquale know whether there was a discourse about choosing between a constitution written by one person or by an assembly, because I think in 1799 you could say, well, we didn't rely on a lawgiver, and look what happened.
I'm pretty sure that the proposal of having a constitution in 1789 written by, well, the king, I guess, unilaterally, was...
He's not extraordinary.
Let me give one example from French constitutional history suggesting why a single person might not be ideal. I say in the paper, and Pasquale pointed out to me that I exaggerate, that 1958 constitution was essentially written single-handedly by de Gaulle, which it wasn't. But suppose that the French, instead of doing it over the summer of 1958, had taken a one-year or two-year period with a full and a panoply of committees and experts and debates. They might have thought of the possibility of cohabitation, which never apparently struck their mind. It's such a simple thing. You know, the current French political system is, in fact, a coexistence of two constitutions. When the parliamentary majority is the same as a presidential majority, you have one constitution. When they come from different sides of the political spectrum, you have another constitution. And so de Gaulle, over the summer of 1958, didn't occur to him, which you might think is...
Well, he wasn't extraordinary.
So, Jan, a quick question on a point you do not discuss in your paper. We may easily agree that there are two types of constituent assembly. Constituent assembly stricto sensu, which are assembly discussing and passing a constitution. Weimar, Rome after the Second World War. And let's say conventions, assembly proposing a text that has to be popularly ratified. Philadelphia, Bonn, 49, and so on. What is your preference?
Well, in the paper I say that there should be a downstream process of popular debate and ratification. I'm not sure I really believe that, but I think it would be in any modern society an absolute political necessity. I think the upstream debate is more important in the selection of delegates, and perhaps also debating the format of the assembly. But in the paper, I cite this to me puzzling fact of proposed constitutions not ratified by referendum. I'm not quite sure what it shows, but I have a student at Columbia who wrote a very good paper for me last fall, showing that of the 12 pure constitutional conventions called in America, in 1960s and 1970s. Seven were turned down by the voters in two cases of a majority of 4-1 or 3-1. So what's going on in a case like that? Presumably framers feel constrained by possible rejection and try to tailor the document so as to, you know, according to low anticipated reactions, to so that it wouldn't be rejected. So so what do I think? Well, I think in those cases, two of them at least, showed that ratification was a good thing because the constitution makers in the convention thought about just striking a deal. And the electorate recognized that the constitution was written in the deal striking mode, not in the proper, you know, constitutional impartial mode. So they turned them down. So I think unless you can eliminate interest very largely from the assembly, you probably should have ratification as a final check on constitutions as deals. That happened twice in Canada, that the Canadian voters thought in 1982, I guess, and 1993, proposed constitutions were just the product of bargains in, you know, smoke-filled backrooms, which they largely were, and rejected them. Not so much on substantive grounds, but on a suspicion that here somebody had cut a deal.
So you argue for a proportional representation for the election of the members of a constitutional assembly, and I would have thought that the argument for that would be just that this is a more democratic form of election, and which, in the case of an ordinary parliament, has to have some reason why, in the name of effectiveness, why you may depart from it, and there are no such reason in the case of a constitutional assembly, and that would be good enough. But you invoked a more original reason, namely that this would guarantee help guarantee diversity and representativeness, which were important for optimal information gathering. And there I'm not quite clear what you have in mind, because you think of information gathering in the case of a constitutional assembly, part of it has to do with expertise about regarding past histories of constitution and constitutional problems, and I don't see that the representativeness will change anything, or else it's got to do with local circumstances, which are typically very much common knowledge. So if you think of a Lebanese constitution with, and the representation of a different religion from the president of the republic to the prime minister, and so, well, the knowledge to be gathered is very much public. So I'm not sure, really a real question. What do you have in mind? Can you be more specific?
Take the delegates to the third estate at the French Assemblée Constituante, who are mainly magistrates and lawyers. How much did they know about France? Compared, for instance, to the parish priests. And I think that was Beard's argument too in An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, that he was able to explain, he thought, the outcome of the Constitution by representation of different economic groups, not as having voted their interest, but as representing knowledge of local conditions that political scientists would not have. So it was an argument against the abstract knowledge that political theorists might have, and the hands-on knowledge of local conditions.
But wouldn't you get that with if it is democratic at all, even with a relatively high threshold, you would get that anyhow. I mean, that's an argument against having just experts.
No, I think there might be substantial minorities that would not be represented at all if you had a high threshold. So that's, I suppose, at least the claim.
Well, thanks very much for...